The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Show. I'm Sam Livingston and I will be your guest host on today's show. Mr. Stephen Fleury is still in Jerusalem. I believe they are leaving today, if not today, tomorrow morning. He's hoping to do the show live tomorrow from our campus at Edstone. On today's show, we'll do about 30 minutes of news. I'll run through some headlines, but we also have a special interview from Mr. Fleury with our trumpet correspondent in Jerusalem, Brent Nagtegal. We'll play that interview in the second half of today's show. It's about 20 minutes long, and it's an update on the developments and the work going on right now in Jerusalem. And then after that, we'll come back and we'll read a few emails. Any comments, feedback you have for the show, you can send that to td@thetrumpet.com. If you want to request any of the literature on today's show, you can visit our website, request through that email address, or call our phone number 1-866-930-3024. 1-866-930-3024. Go ahead and start today's show with the latest numbers on inflation. This came out this morning. This is from Washington Examiner. Inflation rises to 7.9% in February. That is the highest in four decades. Now, we've been watching this go up each month, year over year. I think last month it was 7.8% for the month of January over the previous 12-month period. This is from the Examiner. They write, the much-anticipated numbers reported by the Bureau of Labor Statistics on Thursday revealed the extent of the inflation that has plagued the United States during its recovery from the coronavirus pandemic. The pace of inflation is the highest it has been since 1982. February's inflation increase comes after a year of price increases. Year-over-year inflation was at a meager 1.7% in February 2021, before increasing to 2.6% in March, 4.2% in April, and 5% in May. So this is Biden's problem. This is a problem that he has to own. The Examiner writes, for most of the summer, inflation hovered at just over 5% before once again ballooning over the following month. So 7.9%, that's the highest that it's been in 40%. I won't get into all of the news about interest rates, but a lot of comparisons to the 70s and a lot of analysts saying how this is going to be much, much worse than what was happening in the 70s because of the way we're still printing and spending money, because of how low those interest rates are and how easy it is to borrow money. This clip was floating around on social media. It's pretty interesting to see the financial analyst on CNBC react to this latest news about the rising inflation. This is clip one.
And of course, this inflation news is going to be tough for the administration. Nothing, Joe, nothing has been more politicized than inflation. Just let's hearken back to all the things we've been through. First, it was transitory. Then inflation is good. Then we went to corporate greed. Now we're at Putin.
He's calling out the Biden administration. He says, first they said it was transitory, this isn't going to last very long. Then when they realized, well, this is going to be around, they'd say things like, well, it's not, it's good because income is rising at the same pace, which I don't actually think that's true. And then you'd hear Stephanie Ruhle over on MSNBC say, look, we can all afford to pay a little bit more. That didn't float very well. So then Biden started blaming the corporations, especially with the prices of beef. He always says, well, there's just four companies and there's not a lot of competition and they're colluding together to drive up the prices, as if that's the only thing that is increasing in price. And now, like that analyst said there, now they're just blaming everything on Putin. What a convenient excuse, as if inflation wasn't a thing the past year. They do the same with oil, as if oil prices hadn't doubled in Joe Biden's first year of occupying the White House. And then the sound bites over the past couple of days, Stephen Colbert, he had this segment talking about, I don't care how high gas prices are because I drive an electric car, as if we could all afford to just, you know, if you're complaining about rising gas prices, you probably don't have the extra money to go and buy a brand new car and pay $400 or $500 a month for that payment. But that's the messaging coming from this administration, coming from the regime comedians. Just go spend $60,000 and buy yourself an electric vehicle. You never have to pay attention to the price of gas ever again. I mean, it's so insulting. And then when the food prices rise, we played that clip a few weeks ago, that the analyst saying, well, just stock up on rice and beans and don't put any meat, like try to really dilute the meat in the food. And again, that's not a bad meal at all. But you just see that this administration, someone joked their motto is lower your expectations. Don't expect too much of us. Well, switching over to Biden's handling of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we've heard a lot about how the administration didn't boycott oil for the longest time. They've finally done that. It remains to be seen how that's enforced, how long it'll take before it's enforced. But there are still quite a few things that in this globalized world, we have not been able, and we probably won't be able, to disconnect ourselves from Russia. This is from Reuters. They say, U.S. ban on Russian energy imports does not include uranium. U.S. President Joe Biden's ban on American imports of Russian oil and other energy products announced on Tuesday does not include a ban on imports of uranium for nuclear power plants. The U.S. power industry relies on Russia and its allies, Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, for roughly half of the uranium powering its nuclear plants. Now, reading this, you think, how did the United States get to a point where this is our Cold War enemy? As much as we talk about how, or as much as they talk about how evil Putin is and evil Russia is, how is it that half of our nuclear power plants are reliant on energy from an enemy nation? Reuters continues, the industry has been lobbying the White House to continue to allow uranium imports from Russia despite Moscow's invasion of neighboring Ukraine. There is no U.S. uranium production or processing, though several companies have said they would like to resume domestic production in Texas or Wyoming if nuclear power producers sign long-term supply contracts. So it's just like oil. We have plenty at home to become self-sufficient in this, and yet we're relying on Russia and Kazakhstan. Now, Hillary, when she was Secretary of State, she sold off or signed off on this deal to allow Russia to buy a lot of these uranium mines that the United States is reliant on. And this is part of Putin's game plan, is he's buying up these resources. He wants to make it hard for other nations to get these resources. He wants people coming to him, and it's been a strategy that's been in the works really for decades with him. He is cold and calculated. Now, Wyoming, Texas, like that article points out, they have plenty of uranium, and yet the United States has to look to Russia for energy needs. This is an article by Andrew Miller from 2020. This is at thetrumpet.com. It's titled, Russian Control of U.S. Uranium is a National Security Threat. He writes, most Americans do not understand how important uranium is to their national security. Nuclear power plants generate about 20% of the nation's electricity. That means that America's 98 nuclear reactors must be fed over 40 million pounds of uranium each year so they can produce the electricity we need. The United States mining industry extracts less than 1% of the nation's uranium needs each year. To make up the difference, U.S. power plants import about 40 million pounds of uranium from foreign nations. America currently buys about 40% of the uranium oxide it needs to keep its reactors running from Russia and other former Soviet states. So uranium, Putin's evil. Putin's bad. We have to stop selling or stop buying their oil. You know, ban McDonald's isn't going to sell their food over there. All these other unhealthy restaurants are closing down in Russia. But we are dependent on them for this crucial part of our infrastructure. I remember it was pretty close to the start of when Biden took the White House. He had that meeting with Putin and he handed him that list of these are 16 critical parts of our infrastructure that if you attack, you know, we're going to retaliate with powerful sanctions. I imagine that nuclear power plants would have been on that list. And I imagine Vladimir Putin is not ignorant of the fact that the United States depends on Russia and Kazakhstan to supply uranium. How much of that is calculated into his decision making? The United States can't back off of buying that. Another product that we get a lot of from Russia is nickel. And the price of nickel 2 days ago, it doubled. Before, it's tripled since Putin invaded Ukraine. Russia is the world's biggest exporter of nickel. It's also a crucial component of batteries for electric vehicles. So this administration tells you, go buy that electric vehicle. You never have to worry about gas prices again. And there's no way for Putin to leverage oil over us. We'll be totally free, as if all of the components of these cars just magically appear out of thin air. Expect the price of those batteries to go up if the price of nickel has gone up. This was from Joe Biden. He tweeted this last night. He said, loosening environmental regulations won't lower prices, but transforming our economy to run on electric vehicles powered by clean energy will mean that no one will have to worry about gas prices. It will mean tyrants like Putin won't be able to use fossil fuels as a weapon. This is their approach to a hot war, is pushing the net zero carbon emissions by 2035. This is how this administration is trying to fight a war. They're not taking this problem seriously at all. The Wall Street Journal says sanctions on Russia so far haven't targeted commodity exports directly, but have nonetheless made shipping firms and traders reluctant to deal in the nation's resources. They're nervous about it. Well, when are the sanctions going to come? And that's driving up the price of these products. Politico had a good article talking about Biden's heavy hand with these sanctions. And of course, there needs to be a strong response to what Vladimir Putin is doing. But look at how this is backfiring. Politico's article is titled, "The West Has Declared Financial War on Russia. Is it prepared for the consequences?" On Tuesday, the U.S. announced it would ban imports of Russian oil, a largely symbolic but politically escalatory measure. Western leaders have chosen to match the severity of Russia's war of choice with severe financial pressure, dwarfing the maximum pressure campaigns of the Trump era. But the West's response is no longer just pressure. It's financial war. We are in a war. And they say the goal of these sanctions, these are financial sanctions, they're trying to use economic sanctions to influence Vladimir Putin's military strategy. And the gamble is, we don't know if that will work. Often, it takes equal power, excessive power, to deter a military campaign like this. So Joe Biden, and this has been the approach of the West for decades, is, well, sanctions work. Sanctions work, they're going to deter this sort of activity. And Putin is challenging that. These are some of the toughest sanctions that have ever been imposed on a country. Politico writes, failure to forestall Russia's aggressions or to prevent serious ripple effects in the global economy will signal that even the strongest of U.S. sanctions cannot direct a political or military outcome. Policymakers may need to reconsider a tool that has amassed a central role in government decision-making but could lose its legitimacy if the current gamble fails. So it remains to be seen what sort of impact these sanctions will have on Vladimir Putin's decision-making. Biden has admitted it will be months down the road. I mean, Ukraine could be totally conquered before we see the effects of these sanctions. And if nothing changes, well, that signals to the rest of the world's dictators, hey, we can survive if this is America's toughest tool. It signals to China, we can survive. It signals to Iran and Venezuela, and Cuba. And a lot of these countries are forming their own alliances, just like the Bible prophesies. The Trumpet of April 2017, we had an article titled, "Trade Wars Have Begun." This is a war. And as Biden, he's fumbling around trying to, you know, really talk tough, and he's pushing Putin, but at the same time, he can only go so far. One story that was pretty, well, it's not funny, but fascinating to see. He's looking to, and we've talked about this on the show, because we're not going to take oil from Russia, we need alternatives. We're not allowed to pump any oil at home. We're not allowed to go up to Alaska. Biden's running around all over the world trying to find oil anywhere but the United States. So he's going to Venezuela. He's going to Iran. He's going to Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates. He attempted to set up calls with these leaders. I think he was going to travel to Saudi Arabia, and they have ignored him. Wall Street Journal reports the White House unsuccessfully tried to arrange calls between President Biden and the leaders of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. So he's running to these other nations to get them to pump up oil, pump more oil to try to drive down the cost of oil. And they're ignoring him. Now, President Trump, he had a pretty good working relationship with these two countries. They were signing peace deals with Israel and Saudi Arabia. They're in a war in Yemen, and they're fighting the Iranian-backed militia group, the Houthis. So the United States is backing them in that war. Donald Trump said the Houthis, we designate them to be a terrorist group. They supported Saudi Arabia. They got out of the Iran deal, which Saudi Arabia doesn't like. And then Biden gets in, and he does the opposite. He re-ups the Iran deal. He says the Houthi rebels are no longer a terrorist group. He removes that support for Saudi Arabia. He does all this tough talk, and then he comes crying to them asking for oil, and they just give him the cold shoulder. The United States is being embarrassed on the world scene right now. On top of that point of the United States being embarrassed, the person this administration chose to send, the delegate they chose to send to the European Union, to Europe, in the midst of what many are calling the start of World War III, they send Kamala Harris. And a lot of reporters say, this is Kamala's moment. This is her moment to shine. They say that every couple of weeks, and then she totally ruins whatever opportunity she was given. This morning, she was speaking in Poland, and this is her response to a pretty serious question about the refugee crisis in Ukraine and what the United States would do to help these refugees. And just notice, you can tell she's totally unprepared for this question. This is clip two.
And relatedly, is the United States willing to make a specific allocation for Ukrainian refugees? And for President Duda, I wanted to know if you think, and if you asked the United States to specifically accept more refugees.
Okay. A friend in need is a friend indeed. Okay.
I can first. Okay, so this time.
I laugh sometimes. I don't want to rag on him for laughing, but if you go back and you look at, think about this as World War II, because people are saying this is World War III, and that's the individual that we're sending over there to reassure our allies that the United States has their back. As serious as people are saying this is, as serious as it is, you could tell during that question she had no clue what she was going to say. Now, she was not popular in the primaries. She was not going to be voted president. She was inserted in, she was told by Barack Obama to be vice president, and they're forcing her on the world. And you have to wonder, is this just part of the plan to embarrass the United States? Mr. Falk talked about childish leadership on his program. I think that was on Monday or Tuesday. And there she is laughing about refugees, millions of refugees. How are you going to handle this? It wasn't a funny question at all. How much does Barack Obama love watching this administration fumble around because he loves watching America fail. He loves watching the United States be embarrassed. On top of being embarrassed, Congress yesterday, they rushed through this $1.5 trillion budget package, this budget bill for the remainder of the year. And it's amazing. These bills are thousands of pages long. Republicans usually complain, well, how are we supposed to sign, how are we supposed to read this and then have a vote on it the next day? But this one, it's bipartisan. They're talking about how unified everyone is because, well, we've got to get, normally these things stall, they take forever. There's a lot of back and forth, and for good reason. I mean, that's by design, is that the U.S. government is generally pretty slow. But now they're able to work pretty quickly. This is from The Hill. They write, Senate Minority Whip John Thune, a Republican from South Dakota, said ahead of the text unveiling that he expected the bill to fetch robust bipartisan support. I would expect a fairly robust vote, bipartisan vote, and a lot of it has to do with, again, just a sense of urgency of getting assistance to Ukraine. Not about the United States, not about what's in this budget. They were originally going to allot $10 billion in help to Ukraine. I hope they follow that money because they didn't do it last time Joe Biden handed over $1 billion. So $10 billion, Mitch McConnell pumped it up to $14 billion. That sliver, that's a ton of money, but that's a sliver of $1.5 trillion. And that alone is why everyone is like, oh, we have to support this bill, run it through, don't worry about it. $1.5 trillion, oh, it's for Ukraine. We have to do it for Ukraine. Never mind pumping all that extra cash into a nation that's struggling with inflation. Suddenly these politicians get a lot done when it's for Ukraine. You've probably heard a lot about this story of the bio labs in Ukraine. Tucker Carlson did a big segment about it last night. A couple weeks ago, there was this rumor going around that the United States was funding these biosafety lab level 3 labs in Ukraine. Now, level 3 is obviously right below level 4. Level 4 is the highest. They handle the deadliest diseases. That's where the Wuhan flu came from, that lab in Wuhan. That's a level 4. So Ukraine has these labs, and they're wondering, well, why is the United States working with Ukraine in these labs? And what's going to happen to them now that Russia is invading? Now, immediately when that came out, all the fact checkers came and said, that's a false story. It's not real. There's nothing going on, or the United States is not working with Ukraine in these labs. And then Marco Rubio brought it up in a hearing on Tuesday to Victoria Nuland. And the fact that she's back in power just, again, proves this is Barack Obama's third term. But notice her response to Rubio's question, clip 3.
Does Ukraine have chemical or biological weapons?
Ukraine has biological research facilities, which, in fact, we are now quite concerned Russian forces may be seeking to gain control of. So we are working with the Ukrainians on how they can prevent any of those research materials from falling into the hands of Russian forces should they approach.
I'm sure you're aware of that.
So he cuts her off, but she doesn't answer his question. Does Ukraine have chemical or biological weapons? Well, Ukraine has research facilities, and now a lot of people are wondering, are there chemical weapons there? And the United States is saying this is Russian propaganda because they're planning to use chemical weapons, and that could very well be true. It's hard to trust anyone. I certainly don't trust anyone in the current administration of the United States. I don't trust Russia, Ukraine. You can't trust any of these people. But later on, we learn that the United States has worked in these labs. And the fact there that she says, we're working with the Ukrainians on how they can prevent any of those research materials from falling into the hands of Russian forces. Well, these are level 3 labs. Russia has level 4. So ideally, whatever's in these labs should not be as bad as whatever Russia has. And yet the U.S. State Department is worried about Russia gobbling up whatever could be in these labs. Pretty interesting little development going on there right now. And when you see the State Department's reaction to this story, they came out in full force. They tweeted this statement, fact, the United States does not have chemical and biological weapons labs in Ukraine. The U.S. is in full compliance with its obligations under the Biological Weapons Convention and does not develop or possess chemical and biological weapons anywhere. Well, we've heard them try to excuse what they were doing in Wuhan. It remains to be seen, obviously, what will happen in Ukraine. But the Bible does prophesy about these sorts of weapons being used. And it is frightening to hear about even the possibility of this coming up in Ukraine. All right, well, we'll transition now to that interview that I mentioned at the top of the show. We'll go to a promo, and then after that, this is an interview that Mr. Stephen Fleury had with Brent Naugtegal. They recorded this interview this morning from Jerusalem, so we'll go to a promo and then lead right back into that.
The Trumpet Daily.
I'm speaking to you from our television studios in Pasadena, where I speak to the world as a voice crying out in the wilderness of modern religious confusion.
Herbert W. Armstrong was the world's leading televangelist and one of the most prominent religious leaders of the 20th century. Watched, read, and followed by millions worldwide. But his legacy of Bible-based humanitarianism came under attack after he died. The cabal of leaders who took control of the church he founded, after pledging to follow in his footsteps, methodically destroyed all he had built. Those who would stop them were silenced or excommunicated. This shocking story of betrayal and deception is told in Raising the Ruins. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com.
The Trumpet Daily.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily. We're coming to you today just outside of the Old City in Jerusalem. Behind us is the Jaffa Gate. I'm here with our Jerusalem correspondent, our bureau chief here in Jerusalem, Brent Naugtegal, and he's going to start by just giving us, we're going to tell you about the trip we've had this past week and what we have planned in the next few months. But you've been here for, you said 6 years earlier, so maybe you could give a little summary of your involvement in the excavations with Dr. Elat Mazar over the years and then with your family here in Jerusalem.
Yeah, sure. So I think all the listeners are aware that Herbert Armstrong College is connected to the Trumpet Daily and the college sponsors excavations over here and has done for some time. And so I came over as a student volunteer as part of the college from back in 2006. And that was on the excavations of Dr. Elat Mazar. This was the Palace of David excavations. And from that point on, I've kind of been able to come back for each of Dr. Mazar's different seasons of excavations on the palace, but then also a little bit an area a bit further to the north of that called the Ophel. And we've been able to excavate with her, and I was a supervisor in her excavations. And since 2016, though, after I was a student, I was employed over here, and my family's now here. I've had three children over here. I came over here just married, but now I've got three, and they're all born here in Jerusalem, and we're looking forward to doing more excavation.
Wow, so quite the history. You lived with us in 2007,
yes.
And you didn't live in the same structure in 2012, but you were here for the 6 months that my family was here. And then, of course, since then, we've shuttled back and forth. But you said all three of your children were born in Jerusalem, and then you were married in 2000...
I was married in 2013. I had a couple of years in the United States, or 3 years, and then straight over here for the last six.
Okay, and then maybe besides the excavations, you can tell the viewers about the podcast that you work on, the publications that you support, the writing that you do as well.
Yeah, so the podcast that comes out once a week is related to archaeology, biblical archaeology. It's called Let the Stone Speak. This is a new podcast that is kind of, it kind of goes over a lot of the different material that we go through in our magazine, Let the Stone Speak. It just came out This is a magazine that people all over the world can get to. It follows biblical archaeology, latest discoveries, biblical history, and the importance of that. And so the podcast is every Sunday here from Jerusalem. It goes up online probably on the Monday, but people can certainly watch that. It's on YouTube, and it's also at thetrumpet.com there on the podcast, so they can get to that. We also do writing for The Trumpet over here as well. So archaeology is one side of it, and then we also write on Middle Eastern news and prophetically significant news. And so I've been able to go on lots of different media tours. I think if people might recall, a couple of years ago, I was over in the close to the Gaza Strip, and we weren't thinking we would see anything, but ended up being one of those times where you're just running like lots of Israelis are to bomb shelters and things like that. And so you definitely get a firsthand account living here, and witnessing the tensions between the Palestinians and the Israelis, of course. But more and more, it seems these days, the attention is being brought to more of the archaeology, especially, I would say, over the past 6 months, the archaeological work has definitely increased.
We mentioned Dr. Ilat Mazar. Most of our viewers are aware of the fact that she died 10 months ago, just a towering figure in the world of biblical archaeology. We just had lunch with her lovely sister, who's still working to deal with the after effects of all of that. But yeah, for our part, working with her since 2006, that was what an 18 what was it 15 years relationship,
and yeah, a long time.
It kind of culminated in the reception that we had honoring her legacy back in 2018, and this was when we sponsored a dig at the Ophel site. And then, of course, after that, the world kind of went a little bit crazy with the lockdown and all those things, and she was really sick during that period, and then dies. And of course, for our work with her all those years in excavating, and we helped her process a lot of the finds, we helped her with some of her publications and such, you kind of looked at that and thought, okay, that's a major setback for the work that we're doing in Jerusalem, but it really hasn't been. It's almost been like there's more activity going on for us in Jerusalem in just carrying on her legacy and, of course, Herbert Armstrong's legacy. So maybe you could just kind of describe or summarize what has happened since her death that really has been pretty exciting for us and for many of our viewers.
Right. Yeah, Dr. Mazar and the relationship we worked on with her for such a long time, it really became a familial relationship. And with all the volunteers that came over, the students, she just took them under her wing. And a lot of them maintained contact with her over the years as well. And she would write emails back to them. And she wasn't the most notorious one for responding to emails. And yet when our students did, she really felt really close to them. And so when she died, it was a shock for us, hands down, because we expect to do so much more work in Jerusalem. But it was also, I think, a shock for the archaeological world. And I remember attending her funeral and being with a lot of the colleagues of hers and ours, and we're looking around thinking, well, what's going to happen now? She's involved in the excavations in the most important area of the most important city in the world, and they're unfinished. Both the ones at the Palace of David and the ones at the Ophel, they're unfinished. And since her death, a lot of things have opened up, and she really did set us up to be able to continue to work on those areas. She talked to an archaeologist, Professor Yosef Garfinkel at Hebrew University, the head of the Institute of Hebrew University's archaeological department. And she talked to him really shortly before she died and said that, you know, these are the areas that need to be continued, and, you know, talk to these people, talk to us, and we know the areas that can really help out, and to know how to, so there'll be a continuation. And so since that time, I mean, we have our relationship with different archaeologists has really blossomed, and we're looking forward to continuing eventually in both areas, but perhaps sooner rather than later on the Ophel.
How soon after her death did you meet with Professor Garfinkel?
So I had met him once or twice before, but when you're somebody like him, he's quite famous as well, he forgets. So I met him, actually he came up to me. This was an event on July 1st. This was just a month and a bit, a month and a couple of days after her death. And we were at an event here at the Begin Center, Menachem Begin Center in Jerusalem. And it was an event honoring her. And there was a number of academic speeches. I got up and gave a short speech about our relationship with her. And then Professor Garfinkel came up straight after and shook my hand, said, "I need to meet you." I had this conversation with her after the excavations, after well, just before she died, and, you know, we're going to go forward together and continue what she started. And Professor Garfinkel's interesting as well. I didn't know this at the time, but he told me that night on July 1st that he actually excavated with Herbert W. Armstrong College's predecessor, Ambassador College, in the 80s. Yeah. He excavated with them in the City of David under Yigal Shalom. And so he's got a connection with us as well.
And Alat Mazar, of course, does. She also excavated with the ambassadors, as she always called them affectionately, back when she was a teenager. Right. So she goes back to the 70s, and then you're saying Professor Garfinkel excavated at the City of David, I guess?
Yeah, just after Benjamin Mazar's excavation, Alat's grandfather's, around the Temple Mount area, there was a break, and so Yigal Shalom, another famous Israeli archaeologist, excavated in the City of David. And so Ambassador College helped there for 4 or 5 years as well, with sending over students, continuing this relationship, but with a different archaeologist.
Yeah.
And one of those archaeology students from Hebrew University that was digging alongside those ambassador students was Professor Garfinkel.
Okay. So switching back to Dr. Mazar, then, following her death and just continuing our relationship with her family, we secured her library and also her grandfather's library, which is about how many volumes?
About 4,000 volumes.
Okay.
And these were books, I mean, some of them, you know, 1886, 1896, that was Benjamin Mazar's library, going through till Elot's latest books that she received from other academics. And what's part of that is so wonderful is you see, if you're a scholar like that, everyone writes a book and they write you a message and they send it to you. And so every second book has a personalized message either to Benjamin Mazar or Elot Mazar.
Right.
And we're able to have that. And as part of the purchase of that library, the family was just ecstatic that it came to us and that it's going to stay in Jerusalem rather than going somewhere else. And it's going to be open to the public. And so everyone, if they want to see the libraries of these esteemed scholars, can come and see them.
Right. And so that was what sort of gave rise to the discussions we had internally about developing the Biblical Archaeology Institute. So maybe you could, I know we've had some changes with the website and the publications here just recently, but maybe you could also tell our viewers a little bit about the institute and the thinking behind that in the last few months.
Right, so we were writing quite a lot about archaeology before under the name of a different magazine, Watch Jerusalem, and we still have that website that's functioning, but we decided that it could be far more effective to just stick with the biblical archaeology for one of the websites. And with the library now, we have to have some place to put it, and so we are increasingly doing more archaeological research from the biblical period as well, and putting a more of a popular, ready, easy to read version of that in our Let the Stone Speak magazine. And so I'm just one of the writers for that. There's a few writers. We have Christopher Eames over here as well. He's writing heavily for that magazine. And then both of us were supervisors on Elot Mazar's digs. And we're in some of the days we're going to Hebrew University to work on processing the finds of Elot Mazar. Those publications process continues as well. And so it's really, I think the goal of our institute, as opposed to some others, and there are some great institutes that are doing great work, ours is really trying to get what's found in the ground through that academic stage as fast as possible so that it can get to the everyday reader, so it can be readily understandable by anyone. You don't have to have a degree in archaeology to understand what's been discovered. And I think that since we're not professors of archaeology, yet we have grown up with it in a way, I think we have a unique window to kind of keep both the facts in mind, but also the audience that's probably not as uninitiated as well.
So the website, that is armstronginstitute.org.
That's right.
Okay, and then the Let the Stones Speak magazine, they can get a subscription to that at the website.
Yeah, the subscription is free. It comes out 6 times a year, so it's bi-monthly. You can go to armstronginstitute.org, and then there's publications tab. Click on that, and you see magazine, and you can order your free copy from there.
Okay, so this week, these last few days, my father's been in town. He's been over here with a few of us, and of course our colleagues here in Jerusalem. Maybe, I guess before I get to that, maybe you can just briefly describe the growth here in Jerusalem with the addition of the Eames family back in August, I believe it was.
Yeah, August is when they came over. Now, Chris is somebody that Mr. Eames has worked on Elot Mazar's excavations since I think he was a sophomore.
Right.
And then soon thereafter he came over and could assist, and he really has a mind for archaeology and for research, and so it's a great fit to have him assisting over here and really doing a lot of the bulk of the heavy writing.
And he was an area supervisor on the last
on the last dig in 2018, that's the final one, the one that we funded. We excavated a cave on the Ophel area that was basically the last glimmer of life before 70 AD destruction, or during that time.
Right.
We found evidence of that inside. And he was the supervisor of that. And so it really made sense, I think, in hindsight even, to bring him down, because the final report of that needs to be written, and the official scientific report, and he's doing a lot of that.
Right.
And so to have him here is wonderful, and not to mention have Panay here, his wife and my wife get along, and they just had a baby last week.
So
fresh one.
Four adults, four children. You guys are expanding the Jerusalem congregation
in
your own special way.
Yeah, and he lives right next door, so we can go back and forth and be together quite a lot. So it's just great having them here.
Right.
It certainly is it was a long stint here without too many other people, just diggers coming in and out. And so to have somebody that's perched, permanently stationed here,
right.
I think we're already seeing great fruit from that.
Yeah. And so this week we've been spending some time with our friends and colleagues here, also some of our partners here in Jerusalem. And we've met with them, we've dined with them, we've also been able to view a few properties. Going back to the institute that Brent spoke of, we're trying to find a place that's nice enough for that big library that we now have.
And
hopefully nice enough to sponsor some exhibits here locally as well. In addition to that, we took a tour through the Ophel site, where we've had so many excavations over the years, as well as the City of David. And maybe lastly, you could just describe what it looks like is in the near future with respect to our involvement with excavations now under Professor Garfinkel.
Right. So there's really three excavations that we're looking forward to. The one that might be off a little bit in the distance is renewed excavations at the Palace of David. There's only 20% that's been found, Dr. Mazar said, and so we're looking forward to push there. In the more immediate term, there's two sites on the Ophel that have our interest. One relates to a Second Temple period, or the period of Jesus Christ was there, and there's a massive ritual bath and some beautiful Herodian or Jesus Christ time steps and walls that continue in some tunnels there, and we want to get in them to expose what was the function of this. And then the other area we're interested in is a massive, absolutely massive tower, a gatehouse that anciently, during the time of King Solomon, people would have entered in through into the city of Jerusalem. This is what was probably known as the Great Tower by people if you're familiar with archaeology. It's something that Charles Warren, a tunneler, found about 150 years ago. And so it's been sitting there for 150 years. We know it's there. It's the most amazing construction from the biblical period anywhere in Israel, and yet it's still underground.
Yep.
And a road's on top of it, too.
Right. It's right under, and Brent was explaining this the other day, it's right under the Ophel Road, which is one of the busiest thoroughfares in Jerusalem. But as he said, Charles Warren, he found it, what was in the mid-1800s?
Yeah.
He couldn't excavate either in his day, but he was able to tunnel around. So he knows this massive structure is there, this Solomonic wall. And so we know it's right under the Ophel Road. You can't just go and remove the road, at least not yet. But we're hoping to get this little patch just on the other side of the road that if we take that down, it'll expose that outer facade of what would be the part of the gatehouse.
It's kind of like a defensive tower that, you know, you walk into it, the gate, and you would make a left turn at this point to go into the city. And this is the wall that protects that initial entrance to the gate. These are pretty common everywhere, but from this period in Israel, but nothing is to the size of this. The preservation that we're expecting is about 20 meters, 80 feet of biblical period wall,
right,
sitting on top of a cliff. Just the Psalms talk about how magnificent this view was and terrifying for invading armies, this specific spot. And so to know that preservation is just sitting there waiting to be touched, I mean, it's something that I think a lot of archaeologists wish had happened already, but we're trying to get it started.
And I know all of our students at Edstone in Edmond are going to be very excited about this news. So hopefully as soon as this summer, we can get some action over here with some of our students excavating in the City of David and the Ophel, which we've been involved in since 2006. Hard to believe. Time is flying by. You are listening to and viewing Stephen Fleury, of course, Brent Nachtigall, as I said earlier. We're both just outside the Old City of Jerusalem in front of the Jaffa Gate. And if you'd like to submit any feedback to the program, you can email the show, td@thetrumpet.com. We'll cut away to a promo and then kick it back to our studio at headquarters.
The Trumpet Daily.
Hello? Hello? Can you hear me?
Do you know me? Do you love me? Do you know I exist? Do you exist? You know what it feels like to not be heard. You know what it feels like to not be answered. Is this how you feel toward God? You don't have to feel alone. You don't have to be distant from God. You don't have to wonder if He will ever answer. You just have to learn how to pray. There is a God, and there are many wrong ways to communicate with Him, but there is a right way. Once you learn how to pray, you will break through and converse with your very Creator. You will experience the most fulfilling, meaningful, thrilling relationship you can imagine. God will hear you. God will love you. God will answer you. If you learn how to pray, go to thetrumpet.com and search how to pray.
The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily. It's nice to get that update, that interview from Israel between Mr. Fleury and Brent Nachtigall. If you wanted some more details, some updates on just the financial side of the work and the other projects that we have coming up over there, I'd encourage you to listen to Mr. Locher's program from Tuesday. A lot of neat tidbits in that interview. I didn't know about Joseph Garfinkel's work with the Young Ambassadors. I'm probably not saying his first name correctly. Exciting about the potential of getting a permanent building there for that institute and to have that library put in there. It's some very exciting things going on over there. I thought that that exhibit, as Mr. Nachtigall, or sorry, the excavation on the Ophel that Mr. Nachtigall was describing is really exciting. Like he said there, it's this 80-foot cliff pretty much, and I've been there. I've stood over that road, and it terrifies me to walk up to the edge of that because it is like a cliff. So one thing I'm really looking forward to is seeing how they excavate that area, and obviously you'd have to watch your step very carefully over there. But hopefully those developments, like Mr. Fleury said, will be coming in this summer. Well, like you said there at the end, you can email any comments, td@thetrumpet.com. We'll go ahead and read through a few emails that have piled up from over the past couple of weeks. This writer says, "Well, we all know what the word of the day is, turbo. I wish I had a tally sheet of how many times Mr. Palmer said turbo and turbocharged. Great ending, great way to end the program, turbo ending." I should tally how many times that person said turbo in that two-sentence email. Another one, "No matter the guest host on the Trumpet Daily, the exact same message of God's truth, warning, and hope is trumpeted loud and clear for all to hear, heed, and admire. Thank you all behind the mic, the camera, and the scenes to make the greatest live stream in the world ever greater." And this person, along with many other people, would like for the program to be extended in length to 2 hours. They want to stress us out even more. Another writer, "Thank you all for subbing in for Mr. Fleury, giving him an opportunity to wear yet another hat." Thank you. Oh, that's a lot of descriptions there. "Thank you all for your diverse, unified presentations. What a perfect, awesome, complete, wonderful world tomorrow in store for us all. As always, my prayers are with you. Onward, Christian soldiers." This individual says, God bless you, Andrew Locher. I always enjoy it when you fill in for Mr. Stephen Fleury. You have great insight and are a very engaging speaker. This one says, the day Ukraine was bombed by Russia, I was reading the book, The Prophesied Prince of Russia. I couldn't believe I was actually seeing on television and reading at the same time Bible prophecy happening. How awesome it is. Mr. Gerald Fleury wrote The Prophesied Prince of Russia, and it was published 5 years prior to Russia attacking Ukraine in 2022. I actually think that might have been published before that first invasion of Ukraine in 2014. If not, he was definitely speaking about it and giving Key of David programs about it, and then possibly the booklet came after that. But we've been watching that trend at the Trumpet for decades, as we've covered on this program in recent weeks. They continue, I can't even put into words the wonderful effect all of this has put into my life. I have no fear of this world, but I do fear God and what will happen to those that do not follow him. My husband and I watch the Trumpet daily every day and also the Key of David on Sundays. Thank you for giving the world the gift of tomorrow's news today and the Key of David. This one is from Abu Dhabi. I believe that's in the United Arab Emirates. They say, I honestly do not know how to express to you my immeasurable appreciation and sincere gratitude for what you and your news gatherers do for me, my family, the brethren, the Laodiceans, and the world. The Trumpet Daily is the absolute best show anywhere, anytime. The only way it could possibly be better would be to have a longer 99-minute or two-hour show. There's another one wanting more time. I love your program and your father's and Mr. Falk's and all the others. May God hasten the coming of his kingdom. I just watched your program about Germany and looked online at Fox News, and not one word about it. Our media is truly blind to what's going on in the world. Thank you for all you do. Otherwise, we would be the same. That point has been hitting me a lot more over the past few months, really since the election in 2022. You've got a lot of these conservative media are sellouts. They're not covering the important news. In a lot of ways, I feel like they're just turning into tabloids. I saw an article about Fox News and Newsmax, and if you watch those networks, they are really promoting the vaccine on those shows, and sometimes they're doing it very awkwardly and clumsily, and it turns out they're being paid by the administration, I can't remember if it's FCC or whatever it is, to promote propaganda to push the vaccine on their viewers. Now, they're definitely more conservative, and you'll get a lot of news on there that you won't get on CNN. But if you want real news, if you want the truth behind the news, if you want vision, if you want to know what the Bible teaches, if you want to know what's really important in your world, visit the Trumpet website. Another email, I wasn't sure if I would be alive to witness the fall of the English-speaking peoples and the formation of the 10 nations or group of nations in Europe led by Germany. That's the end of that email, so it sounds like they will be alive to witness that. Another one, I just knew on Sunday that this week would be an eye-opening week for prophecy, and well, you haven't disappointed. You've explained what's happening in the events of the world so perfectly with Bible prophecy, and it made me take out my copy of He Was Right to read it again. I especially want to thank you for reading the emails today from other viewers. Each one had something to say that I could probably not be able to put into words myself. I wish that I had the talent for writing like Mr. Hilliker. Yes, I remember Mr. Armstrong banging on the table saying, blow the dust off your Bible and read it for yourself. And it is very plain to see that God has put the final part of his plan for mankind in place. It is now becoming very clear that our Lord is coming soon. God bless the PCG. A couple short ones. Love the new episode on Ukraine, and that is not a typo. Trubama, I guess that's Trudeau and Obama. Best sources for reliable news. Toe-to-toe Joe, an instant classic. What a week. I started out this week. They're talking about Canada and how quickly events shifted from the communist crackdown in Canada to the invasion of Ukraine. It seems like that news event was months ago now. It's amazing to see how quickly events are moving in this world. Well, if you have any feedback or comments for the show, you can email td@thetrumpet.com. If you want to request any of the literature on today's show, 1-866-930-3024, hopefully 3024. Hopefully Mr. Fleury will be back live for tomorrow's show from Edstone. Thank you for joining us.